Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here for episode number 445. In just a few moments, I'll be sharing my conversation with my recurring guest, Barbara Carnes, who is an internationally recognized author, speaker, and hospice pioneer. She's the author of the Little Blue Hospice book that some of you may be familiar with. And in this conversation, Barbara and I will talk about grief and bereavement on the hospice journey. And this is both a professional and a personal conversation that I think you'll find heartfelt and hopefully very inspiring and interesting. So I'm glad you're joining us to listen in. But I wanted to bring up something that came up during my conversation with Barbara, which is the fact that many hospices face staffing limitations that make it difficult for them to offer the level of bereavement support that they would like. And I've talked with a number of hospices who said they simply can't manage it. They don't have enough staff to actually provide the type of support they'd like to give to families who are grieving after the death of their loved ones. And I wanted to mention that the text message-based service Help Texts actually has a plan for organizations to join, such as a hospice, who can provide help texts to the families of their patients as part of their bereavement support program. And so help texts also can be sent to healthcare providers and to support people of those who are grieving. They also have text messages for caregivers who are actively caring for their loved ones. So if you're not familiar with help texts provide text-based grief support that includes thoughtful tips and resources about life after loss all year long. The text messages are curated by grief experts and authors and can be customized based on relationship, cause of death, and more. Subscribers also receive personalized text messages for grief anniversaries and special days and extra support around the holiday season. And friends and family members who want to help with grief but aren't sure how can be added to the subscription, and help texts will text them grief support tips and reminders of important dates. This is such a valuable service. I myself have used it, and I found the messages extremely informational, supportive, inspiring, and I think this could be an excellent addition to any organization's bereavement program. You can talk with people at help texts and find out how you might be able to get involved with what they're offering and make it something you offer to the families of your organization as well. And if you use my special link, which is helptexts.com/EOLU, you'll be able to get a discount when you sign up for help texts. I highly recommend it. They've done studies. 95% of the people who received help texts say they find it very helpful. So check it out. Go to helptexts.com/EOLU to learn more about it. And click on the tab for organizations. If you are a hospice or healthcare facility, even a funeral home, or maybe even a financial planner's office who would like to be able to offer bereavement support to patients, clients, and families, and healthcare providers. So I do hope you'll check that out. This week, I want to thank my newest supporters on Patreon, Jenny and Christine, who both just signed up. And I'd like to thank Jean for buying me a coffee. There were no last names this week, just first names. But thank you, Jenny, Christine, and Jean, for offering me your support. I really appreciate it. This was a big week for people on the Patreon page who are part of the community there, because we had the end of life news update that always happens at the end of the month. Also, the What to Watch bonus, which is a list of some programming that's available on television and streaming networks that people can watch that deal with death, grief, the afterlife. And so I just have been creating that to put out there some interesting things that you might like to take in. And then we also had an introduction of the next book for the month of March for A Year of Reading Dangerously. All those things have come out all at once for the Patreon community. So if you're interested in getting some of those bonuses, you can check it out at patreon.com/EOLU. Once again, thank you to everyone who's been making contributions for the last few years. It means so much to me and I really appreciate it. Now we'll move on with my conversation with Barbara Carnes. I'll be back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, once again, I am so excited to welcome my frequent guest, Barbara Carnes. And I have just loved it. Barbara and I've been meeting every other month for probably almost a couple of years now to have conversations together for this podcast. And it's time for another one. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Barbara for if there's anyone out there at by this time who doesn't know Barbara, but just to make sure you're all familiar with her. She is an internationally recognized author, speaker, thought leader, and expert on end-of-life care and the dynamics of dying. She's really one of the pioneers of hospice care. She was recognized in 2018 as a hospice innovator by the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. She is the author of what we in hospice call the Little Blue Book, Gone From My Sight, The Dying Experience, which has been sold all over the world. The last I looked, it said 30 million copies, but there are probably even more now, Barbara. It's been published in 12 languages. And that little book alone has done so much good to educate people, especially families and caregivers, about what to expect as their loved one is dying. And so every hospice I've ever worked with has used it. And we had, you know, stacks of copies to give out to every hospice family. And it's such an amazing contribution that Barbara has made. However, she's also written a number of other books as well. The book, her most recent book is By Your Side, A Guide for Caring for the Dying at Home. And then Barbara, you also have a book on grief. I think it's called My Friend, I Care.
I do. I like to have it used as a sympathy card. I left a space on the inside cover for you to write your personal notes. And you're giving something of substance and yet reaching out. And so that's My Friend, I Care.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. And our topic for today is to talk about grief and bereavement. And we're going to get personal here and kind of share our own experiences as well. So go to Barbara's website, bkbooks.com, and you'll find all of her books there. And it's well worth it to stock your library with all the titles that Barbara has written. So we're going to move on with our discussion now, but I wanted to open it, Barbara, by talking about a video that was on TikTok and Instagram by the country western star Toby Keith, who was dying of stomach cancer. He got diagnosed about 2 years ago, and he just died in February 5th. But he recorded a video talking about his decision to go on hospice. And he recorded it for all of his fans to hear his thought process, why he was stopping chemotherapy, which doctors told him was not helping and would not benefit him at all. And he talked all about hospice and how he had signed the papers, all the benefits his family was receiving, and how amazing it was to be getting comfort care and being at home with surrounded by his family, and what a beautiful experience it was. And I just wanted to comment on that and get your thoughts on it, because I think it's so valuable when a celebrity like this publishes something having to do with hospice and such a positive testimonial.
Well, it is. And because hospice has a confused message. that I think is a detriment to the wonderful services that they provide. And so to have someone in the public eye clarify and talk about hospice, I think that it's kind of erases some of the, do I say, bad press that we tend to hear. Unfortunately, people talk a lot about negative things and don't necessarily come forward with positive. That's kind of human nature. So it really is a gift to anyone who listens to really understand the benefits of hospice care. And so he really did a great service, not just for his fans, but anyone who is listening, because at some point, everybody's going to need end-of-life care. And hospice is a great support during that time.
And it's so credible to people when one of their idols, someone that they've looked up to and been following for a long time, can talk about hospice, because as hospice professionals, no matter what we say about hospice, it will never be as compelling as a person who's actually experiencing being a patient in hospice, and especially someone like him who's looked up to. And so I was so appreciative that he chose to make that video and to be so honest and straightforward with everyone. And he really gave people a tremendous gift in doing that.
Yes. I mean, his whole career has been a gift. And this was just kind of a beautiful parting. Here's what I want to share. And that was brave. Was very brave of him to do that. And it certainly was a gift to all of us.
Yeah. And one of the things he mentioned in the video is that he is at peace. He recorded this before he died, but he was at peace with the fact that he was going to die, didn't feel afraid, and that for himself, he didn't feel sad. He felt that he'd had a good life, and he felt that it was fine, that now it was coming to an end. So he was not spending his last days of life in regret or remorse. He was really just experiencing love with his family and gratitude. But he did say the one thing that he felt bad about was for his family, who would be grieving after he died. And he knew that. And he said that's the only thing that gave him grief, is knowing that they would experience grief and that there wasn't much he could do about that. And so I thought that was a really good lead in to our conversation today about grief. And I was so glad that he was really honest, for he didn't grieve his own life that he wasn't there, but he grieved on behalf of his family who would miss him when he was gone.
So he was thinking of others really more than he was thinking of himself, which is, how beautiful is that?
Yeah. Yeah. And it just touches upon, I mean, we can't talk about hospice without talking about grief. If we do that, we're being a little bit evasive or dishonest in a way, because grief is just such a big part of this entire journey. And I thought we could begin more, a little more clinical and theoretical by talking about, first of all, what hospice is supposed to provide regarding grief support and bereavement, and which happens in various ways. And then delve in a little bit to the actual experience for people dealing with grief in hospice, which you yourself have recently been through.
Yes. Yep. It isn't until you walk in the shoes that you really, really understand anything.
That's, yeah, so very true. So I guess we could say, technically, according to the regulations, hospices have to provide some sort of bereavement support for families who've utilized hospice. And yet it's not really spelled out what that bereavement support should look like, right?
I know. I wish it were, but on the other hand, you can overregulate something and lose on that side too. So that's kind of a thin line. But suppose the regulations say you follow a person following the death of a loved one or a family member who has been on hospice for a year. And what I'm seeing most hospices offer is a bereavement group, which really you're not going to get anyone to come to that right after the death. You've got to wait a few months, literally a few months. And those support groups are wonderful. The problem is it's hard to get grievers to go. There's a sense of, I just don't have the energy to leave the house. I don't have the energy to meet strangers. And so the griever doesn't go. And so with the hospice bereavement program, that's the biggest obstacle is getting people to the groups, getting grievers to the groups. So what a lot of hospices are doing is sending writ through the mail, written articles and letters on grief on a regular basis, figuring that if the griever isn't going to come to us, we'll go to them. And I don't know how effective the letters and the cards are. I really don't know.
Yeah, and I think some hospices, there's really good intent behind what they do. They definitely want to be supportive of people in their bereavement, and they have a chaplain who maybe focuses in on it or makes a call or reaches out to people. But I've seen other hospices that feel very understaffed in that area, that their chaplain is far too busy to make bereavement calls and to be giving the kind of support they'd like to give. And I think, because for one thing, a bereavement program is one of the benefits, it not of hospice care, but it not only hasn't been outlined what to provide, it's also not necessarily funded. I mean, it's funded along with everything else that the hospice needs to provide for the patient. And I think sometimes bereavement gets left out a little bit or gets short shrift just because there aren't enough personnel and resources to do it the way the hospice might like to do it.
I would like to see hospices use their volunteers in their bereavement program. Grievers will respond to face to face and, have a volunteer assigned to that family before the death so that they have met and they exchanged support for the family. And then when the death comes, that volunteer is the connection, the person connection in the bereavement program. And when that volunteer, when it's been a couple months, have the volunteer go to the house and say and explain, we have this bereavement support group. And you know what? Let's you and I together go. Because now the griever doesn't feel so isolated. There is comfort in having someone go with you. And I think you've got a better chance of getting grievers to show up to support groups if you have that volunteer relationship. And say, I'll drive you. We'll go together. And I think you'll have more attendance that way.
I think that's a beautiful idea and a perfect way, for one thing, to utilize volunteers. At least in the hospices I've worked with, we had a huge pool of volunteers who were ready and willing to do whatever we needed, and oftentimes were underutilized, really. We didn't give them enough to do that would have been rewarding and valuable for them. But the idea of connecting with the family and the patient before the death occurs, and then continuing that relationship and becoming part of the grief support for the family, I think that's really wonderful.
I hope that more hospices hear that and try to incorporate it into their programs.
Yeah.
I will say that being a griever at this point and having had hospice, in looking at the bereavement program, I thought it was interesting that the social worker called after the death, the chaplain called after the death, but I didn't answer the phone. I didn't have the energy to answer the phone for anything. And that hadn't occurred to me before, that just a phone call isn't going to cut it. I think you've got to have face-to-face, show up at the door and, hi, I was in the neighborhood.
And maybe that needs to be grief support without any expectations of, well, I'm showing up at your door because I need to get you to go to this meeting with me. I need to make you do something. But showing up willing to say, I'm here for whatever you need. And even if you don't need to talk, but you just want someone to sit next to you, I'll do that.
Yeah. That all goes back now to what you mentioned earlier, and that is staffing. And the social worker and the chaplain aren't necessarily going to have the time to do that, although I strongly believe that that makes for a great bereavement program. So if an agency doesn't have the staffing to do that, that's all the more reason to use their volunteers.
And I was interested, Barbara, that you said you didn't answer the phone. I remember in the first few months after my father died, I did not want to talk to people. And sometimes I hear advice for supporters who are trying to support someone who's grieving, like make sure you ask them questions about their loved one. Make sure you say their loved one's name. Make sure you're talking to them. But I honestly didn't want that. I needed space. I needed some solitude and I needed silence. I could have used with what we were describing, visitors who didn't have any expectations of me, who might just sit there. But I didn't want to talk. And I don't know if you felt that at all.
Well, I did. And, you know, as working in grief and understanding the dynamics of grief, I didn't know that aspect. I didn't know that I wouldn't have the energy to interact with people or want to. I just wanted to be home alone. I didn't have the energy to be social. And when there was someone here, deep within me, I felt I had to be the hostess. Mm-hmm. I had to use energy. There was a friend or a person in my home, and it was my job to be the hostess. And that's just training, I suppose, from years of, and I didn't have the energy. Therefore, I didn't want anyone here.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I don't know, I look at all the things that are being put out there on social media for support people of grievers, and it seems like there is a lot of push. Make sure you show up, make sure you're there. But at the same time, do you even know if that's what the person you're trying to support needs? And how do you find that out? Because I think you have to make space in your mind. Like, it's possible the person I'd love to go support doesn't need me there right now. And How do you find out? Maybe you just ask the person, do you need to come over or do you need some space? Would you like to just be alone for a while and allow for that and even offer it, because it's very real. It was in my experience, at least. I felt a little shell-shocked and numb, and I just felt like I haven't wrapped my head around fully what has happened here yet. I haven't processed it all. I can't even begin to talk to someone else. Same, that would have been the same with a grief support group. I'm not ready to go to a group where I'm expected to tell the story, because I don't even have, it's not even clarified in my head yet. My head's full of a million different things and I don't have a coherent story yet.
Oh, absolutely. And it's been, for me, it's been almost 6 months, and I'm gradually coming out of that. But I have to say to you, it's gradual, and it's been 6 months almost. There's this sense of social ability and responsibility that I have for those people around me. And it's only when I'm alone that I let those feelings that I have come forward so that I can feel them and experience them, write about them, cry about them. But it's the alone times that I do my best work, not when I've got someone there that I feel I have to entertain.
And that's a really good point. Both you and I are professionals, and we are trained to be professionals. And in our line of work, having to deal with strong emotions like grief every single day, and having to have a place to hold that inside while we still go about our work and function and get the work done. That's been part of our training. So it makes sense for us that we need that alone time and solitude time to finally delve into all those feelings and process them.
There is an aspect to grief that as a professional, I didn't have a clue. And that was, I dealt with all of the standard Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's, you know, grieving and all of that. There is another aspect to grief that was new to me, and that is learning how to live without the person in your life. It goes beyond the sadness that they're not here. It's how do I live? What do I do without them? My husband and I, we were married almost 65 years, and I never lived alone, ever. Went from parents to nursing school to marriage. I have to learn how to be a me instead of a we. And for 65 years, my whole life, I've been a we in some form or another. And it didn't occur to me that you have to learn in your grieving, you're feeling the loss, but you're also feeling, how do I live? How do I do all the tasks and all the chores that he did? And that applies to whether it's a sister or a parent, or being a widow. You have to learn how to be an I.
That's such a good point. And that's something I talked about with Mary Frances O'Connor, a researcher who she talked about the grieving brain, and that literally in her studies, the brain is actually goes into a learning phase after a death, because the brain has to relearn everything, including brushing your teeth at night when your person isn't standing next to you. Every single thing that you do during the day, your brain is learning how to do it all over again in a different way, because because someone that you've loved is not physically present with you. And that takes a huge amount of brain power just to be working on all of that learning. So it makes sense that we need alone time and downtime just for that to be taking place inside our own heads.
It's huge. And I had no idea that how important this new learning how to live, how important it was, till I'm walking in those shoes and go, oh my gosh, this is normal. This is not pathological. Nothing, you know, abnormal is happening. And because most people don't know that, then in addition to all the feelings that we have, all of the missing, all of the grief, then we think there must be something wrong with me. You know, I'm unique in having this problem. And I now realize it's universal. You know, it is part of grief.
And what a service we can do in a way by talking about it and sharing that part of grief with people who themselves are going through it, so they understand it's not just you. This is a normal part of your experience.
Well, and that's where going to a bereavement support group would be helpful, because then you learn about grieving and you share with others. And it's like, oh my gosh, I'm not alone in this. But it's back to getting a person there. But once they're there, it's really valuable to see, because we think something's wrong with me. It's me that's having this problem. No one else would, when in reality, we all do. It's normal.
So maybe the bereavement support group is more helpful a little further down the road, a few months or so. And when someone feels ready now to do the processing and to talk about it and talk about even those issues, the day-to-day issues of being without the person who has died.
Oh, I think that would be very, very helpful. And I think you'd get people. Again, you're going to have to, it's got to be more than an invitation in the mail. But it would be very helpful 6 months. I'll even go 5 months. If you get started, you're clearer having learned what you're an experience. So 8 months, even a year, to then be able to look back and go, oh yeah, I did this and I did that, and see how normal we were during that time.
Yeah, there's something I wanted to ask, if this was your experience at all. When I was grieving, I felt very protective of myself as a medical professional, because I didn't want to be labeled by anyone else as somehow, oh, you're grieving so much, or you're still grieving. Like, well, that sounds like you have pathological grief. And it felt threatening to me as a healthcare professional, that if other people saw that somehow I was suffering in a way that might impact my work, and that could be a threat to my license. And I don't know if it feels like that in nursing, but every time I renew my license, I have to check a box that says I have had no mental or emotional issues. And you know, I mean, that's not real life. Of course, we all have mental and emotional issues all the time, but I felt like I needed to hide a little bit my grieving process. And I don't, as a doctor, and I don't know if that's true for nurses too.
I don't know how it is for others. I know that, and maybe it's just because I do blogs and education, but I felt that what I'm feeling and experiencing has to be normal. I do not believe what I'm going through is pathological. So my premise is I'm going to share all my thoughts and feelings with anyone who wants to hear them, because I want them to see that this is normal, that nothing pathological is happening, with the idea of, well, if Barbara, with her knowledge, is feeling and thinking this, then it must be okay. And so I'm using my others being aware of me as a teaching tool.
And that's perfect. As a leader in this field, it's perfect and so helpful for you to share that, because you help set the bar, at a higher place, so that to remove stigma and judgment from any other professional who's going through this kind of grieving.
Well, and even if you're not a professional, to hear, well, this professional says this, so it must be okay. So I share with anyone who wants to listen.
And you're so generous with that. I love reading your blogs, and you've been really open and transparent about this grief journey for you, which I really appreciate. One thing I wanted to ask you about that I see come up a lot, I see a lot of advice to supporters of grievers about what they say to someone who's grieving, what you should say or shouldn't say. And I worry sometimes that we emphasize that so much that people will be afraid to go. People will be so afraid that they'll say the wrong thing that they may stay away and be nervous about supporting someone. If we emphasize too much, you might do the wrong thing. For me, it felt like no one's going to make my grief worse, excuse me, by something they say. They're honestly, I feel this bad. You saying something, thoughtless, that's not actually going to make it any worse for me. But what do you think about that?
I really think the same thing. I also think that you can be honest and open with someone and say, I don't know what to say. I care about you. I cared about Jack. I don't know what to say, but I want to be here for it. Just to speak from your heart. Now, I think you should stay away from well, he's at peace now, and all of that, the what do you want to call them, platitudes that people come up with. No, I don't want to hear that. But if you just say to me, I care about you, and I don't know what to say, but I'm here for you. That says it all.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think that's the most helpful and the most honest thing anyone could say. And then it also gives you, as the griever, the space to say, thanks, I don't need to talk about it right now. Or, thanks, I need some groceries dropped off. Could you do that for me then?
Come on in and have a cup of coffee. And then, as we're being normal with each other, then that relaxation with each other can be the support in itself.
Yeah, that's so very true, especially with someone that you know well, to just to be in that relaxed state where you feel at ease and it feels normal and comfortable to be together.
And then the griever may share or not.
Or not, yeah.
But at least you've gone and showed up at the door, because again, a phone call isn't going to cut it. I don't think I'm the only one that doesn't answer my phone. So it's I was in the neighborhood, and I'm just checking on you. And want you to know I'm here for you, and not be expected to come in unless they invite you in. But I just want you to know I'm thinking about you.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. And I wanted to ask your thoughts about, well, we talk about anticipatory grief, which is the grieving people might do who have a loved one in hospice, you know, grieving all the other losses that are happening before the death, but even preparing for the death. And I was wondering if you felt you experienced that anticipatory grief before Jack died.
I think from the moment of diagnosis, we all begin grieving. And that's always there in the back of your mind, and that hurts. So Jack also, the patient, the person also begins grieving. And I don't know how conscious we are aware that we're grieving. I'm not sure we're aware of it, but those feelings are there under the surface in everything that goes on. In the back of, or at least in the back of my mind, it was the clock's ticking.
Mm-hmm.
And that I now see, I believe, is part of the anticipatory grief that everyone has once they've been told. Now, I also think a key there is that a lot of people will not acknowledge that death is coming. And so that adds an additional struggle when the thought creeps into their head of, oh, what if Dad's not going to be here? What if the doctors are right? Oh, well, they must not be because Dad's going to fight this. You know, so in our head, we've got this conflict between what really I think we know, but don't want to admit. And that ties in with our grieving as well.
Mm. That makes so much sense, in that it really is a process, and the brain, in a way, I mean, in our minds, it takes a while for us to acknowledge and accept information like that, shocking information, and to really begin to believe it and acknowledge and accept that this is true, this is really happening. And so it's a very gradual, slow process over time, perhaps as our loved one's illness gets worse and worse.
Well, and we're such a death-denying society. And there's that element of, if I talk about dying or death, then it'll surely happen. So I'm going to be the ostrich and not look at and not deal with, because I don't want it to happen. And so that energy and that emotional turmoil we're carrying, and that's going to affect everything that we do. So hospice and end of life workers, when we get that referral in the months before death, that's an aspect that we're supporting and talking about, so that the family doesn't have that internal struggle or fight between denial and reality. And that's where the support and guidance of hospice or end-of-life doulas comes in, and why it's so helpful to not just be doing it on your own.
Mm-hmm. And like your little blue book takes people through the stages and what's happening at various stages, and the signs, the physical signs that are present that dying is drawing near, because those are markers for people to be able to look at to tell themselves, this is reality, this is happening. And I think that, as you said, that kind of guidance is really helpful to people, because on their own, the dying process is something they've never seen before, and they have no idea how to interpret it. And when they get that kind of guidance and support, they can start their grieving process and begin working on it before the death comes, even though I'm not sure, I don't know that that lessens grief after the death comes to have worked on it before, but it may help people engage more with their loved one and know, like, our time is short. We need to be here together. There are things we need to say. There's love we need to share.
Well, and having a life-threatening illness is really a gift. And that's a gift of time. You know, there are only two ways to die, gradual or fast. And gradual death has the gift of, this is your opportunity to do and say and love and be together, everything that you've wanted. This is your opportunity. And with fast death, that's a whole nother grief complication, because then we carry, I wish I had, with us, and have to resolve that. But with a gradual death, you have the opportunity to deal with the I wish I had. I want to.
Yeah. Another thing I think about a lot is, as a hospice provider, in my mind, I think I know a lot about grief, and I've been through a significant grief experience, a couple of them. And so in my mind, I imagine, like, I'm going to be very well prepared for the next grief experience that happens in my life, because first of all, I know all the theories and I know all of the books about grief. And then I've had a couple of losses. But what do you think about that? Can we actually really prepare ourselves for grief, or is it just its own experience when it happens and it'll be whatever it is?
I think it'll be whatever it is. I think that grieving is really an emotional experience. And everything that goes before all that knowledge that we think we have is intellectual. And it isn't till you walk in the shoes of grief, it isn't until you have someone close to you die, that it goes to the emotional level. And everything that you learned intellectually doesn't have the same strength to it, because your emotions override that. So I don't think you can ever be prepared for the death of someone that you know, love, care about, or even is just a neighbor. Because in our heads, other people die. I'm not going to die, and neither is anyone close to me. And when someone does, then it just opens up that Pandora's box that we try to keep the lid on.
And maybe what we can do is we develop tools that help us get through any kind of a challenge or a difficult time, so that those tools will be there, that we can utilize them when we're grieving. And I, for me personally, I think writing was my tool that I used. I wrote in my journal every day, and that really helped me a lot. That was my safe space where I could put down all the emotion. Did you have any tools that you have relied on?
Journal, same thing. And I was writing every day, and now it's maybe once a week I'll sit down. So in the 6 month time frame, that need to get thoughts out has diminished. There's still some, you know, yesterday was my birthday and I missed Jack. I mean, the family was there. And it's like, oh, yeah, this is the first birthday that he hasn't been here. So there's things I use the analogy of grief is like a scar. It's like a wound. And at first, it's this open, gaping wound. And gradually, this wound heals. It heals over, and you have a scar. You will always have a scar in your grieving. You don't, a year later, get over it, and I'm not grieving. The grief is always there. You learn how to live with it, and the periods of intensity gradually space out. But, you know, I use the example of you can be in the grocery store and stand in front of the oatmeal and burst out crying and say he ate oatmeal every single day and he's been dead for 20 years, you know, but something touched the scar that brought all the feelings back. And so my wound is healing over, but it's still red and inflamed. You know, 6 months doesn't mean the scar is there. It'll always be there.
Always be there. Yeah, so very true. I had an experience like that. This was after my cousin died, but being in an art gallery, which was really strange, like it hit me out of the blue, but well, it was actually a photograph that someone made of a mother bear and three cubs. And my cousin had three children and she loved bears and she had stuffed bears and teddy bears everywhere. And her husband had a statue made of a mother bear and three cubs after she died. And I saw that photograph on the wall and it just, I just collapsed almost sobbing in the middle of the art gallery and they didn't know what to do with me, but I just had to leave and, you know, and go sit by myself because it was shocking. I had no idea that would come up or come from me from looking at a photograph on the wall, but you're right. You're not prepared.
Yeah. Touch the scar.
Yeah. Well, there was another thing, another sense I had, which I don't know if other people feel this way, but right after my father's death, especially, something to me about my grief felt sacred in a way, and I didn't want to just share it with anyone. And because I was a doctor in practice, I'd been out of the office for a week and everyone had been told that there had been a death in my family, and that's why I wasn't there. And when I came back to the office, I had patients ask me, who died? What happened? What was that about? And I could not begin to talk about it. And it felt to me like this is a sacred story in my heart. I'm not sharing it with just anyone. And now I do, actually. Now I share it with everyone. I write about it. But in the moment, I needed to keep it very sacred and close to me. And did you have any feelings like that?
I did. I didn't. I mean, even with my children, who were very, very close, I see them all the time. But I didn't share really what I was feeling because it was mine. And I, you know, I listened to them. I encouraged to hear their story. Wanted to be support for them, but yeah, it was private within me. And I'm like you now, I talk about it to anyone who will listen. But early on, it was no, this is inside. This is, and I wasn't secure in my own feelings and emotions and thoughts. So I didn't want to explore them to make sense of them with someone else. I wanted to just do that on my own time. And there was confusion within me that I needed to sort out, and not with a stranger or even someone close to me.
Mm-hmm. That's actually really helpful for me to hear you say that because it normalizes the fact that we may think everyone needs to talk about their grief initially, but a reminder, and we said this at the beginning of our conversation, that everyone's different in their grief process, and we need to honor all of these aspects of a person, all the privacy, the solitude, the sacredness, the need to not talk and to not discuss details and not tell the story until the time is right.
So as you're talking, I'm thinking about, I wanted things to be what I considered normal. I wanted a routine. I wanted what I considered stability in my life. And so I wanted to talk about the weather. You know, I wanted to talk about the grandkids. I didn't want to talk about me and how I was feeling. I wanted that stability of talking about things that I considered normal. Mm. And that was important to me too.
Oh, I love that. And I can see how sometimes we might judge someone who isn't talking about the death or their grief as, oh, they're just avoiding the issue. But honestly, it is that same sense of preserving the grief so that I have time to process it for myself and understand my own feelings. And as you said, the grief is mine. It's mine to do what I need to do with it. It isn't here to serve anyone else, and it isn't about anyone else, and I'm not obligated to share it with anyone until the timing's right and I feel ready.
Oh, absolutely. I will, all by myself, I will put on Jack's favorite TV show and watch it. And kind of like, I'm doing this for you. I'm getting the news from Lester for you. And I don't share that with anyone. I'm now sharing it with many, many. But those are some special moments of almost gratitude of having you in my life. And I want to honor that place that you've had within me. And I'll do that by watching Lester, even though I could care less. So I think part of grief also is our finding that balance. The balance between figuring out how to go on living and honoring the life that we no longer have. And it's a tricky, fragile balance. And hopefully that balance becomes easier to maintain as time goes on.
And that makes sense to me, all the more when you were saying you needed to stabilize the foundation by having people who would come and talk about the weather and what's happening next week, what are the grandchildren doing, what's on our schedule, and talking about the normal day-to-day things of life, because that's even reinforcing for your mind that we're still here, life is still here. Life is still going on. I'm just finding my way around into a new place, but you need that stable foundation. That's what can help you get up every day and keep going and keep working through each day, whatever needs to be done.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm. Wow. This has been such a really touching conversation, Barbara. I love all of our conversations, and I love how open and honest you are and transparent, and that it's just so beautiful. And you are really making such a difference in the world, just being who you are and just sharing your own journey through life.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Now I'm going to cry. We talk about crying in that I'm not a crier. And so part of grief is the emotion wells up and comes out of your eyes, or it can come out of your mouth, but the emotions are in there and they're going to come out somewhere. And they might come out in anger. They might come out in eating. They may come out in tears, laughter. You know, the emotions are there, whether we acknowledge them or not. And I think it's important to recognize that those emotions will come out somehow. And so mine came out in a little tear.
And whatever they are, they're all fine. Yes. The whole breadth of emotion is fine, whatever people happen to experience. Well, thank you, Barbara, my friend, for this conversation. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you.
It's always a pleasure. I appreciate our, twice every other month contact. And I'll see you in a while.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Next time, take care, Barbara.
Okay.
I hope you found that conversation with Barbara Carnes helpful. I really appreciate Barbara's transparency, and it's great for both of us to have this opportunity to share together our personal stories and talk somewhat about our own grief journeys. We've referred to them in the past, particularly both of us have talked before about when our mothers died. But this was even more tender and a little deeper for both of us today. I came away remembering, of course, that every grief experience is unique from person to person, but also for each person. Every grief we experience will be different from any other grief we've had in life. They do tend to be cumulative, so all the grief experiences you have may come together and you may find yourself grieving all of them simultaneously, but each loss in life tends to have its own flavor, I guess I could say, and the grief tends to be a little bit different. So honestly, we can't fully be prepared or know what to expect. Grief is something we just have to meet at the door when it shows up, and we have to find our own way to deal with it. And it really does help to have conversations and to talk about it, even years later, which I'm doing. It's years later when I'm still talking about grief after my father's death and when grief is new and still very tender and raw, as it is for Barbara. So whoever out there listening is experiencing grief right now, just know that you're not alone and there are so many hearts in this space with you. And again, we're all grieving in our own unique way. And yet we have all had our eyes opened to grief and we have compassionate hearts for others who are grieving. So just know there's so much love being sent to you right now if you yourself are experiencing grief. I do hope if you enjoy the content on this podcast that you'll share it with other people who might also benefit from listening. You can share single episodes or just tell them about the podcast. It's also really helpful if you subscribe and leave a rating and review wherever you happen to listen to the podcast. That helps us go up in the rankings so that more people can see the podcast when they're looking for help like this or looking for this content. So in advance, I'll say thank you so much if you take the time to leave a rating and a review. That means a lot to me. Again, if you would like to make a small contribution to keep the podcast on the air, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support. There are three different ways you can make a donation there, and it will be most appreciated, and I thank you so much. I'm using the donations to help me avoid putting ads on the podcast, which I prefer not to do, and to bring outside advertising in, which I think can be really disruptive. So again, thank you. And remember, I'll be back next week with another new interview. I'll be talking with Dr. Aditi Sethi next week about the documentary film The Last Ecstatic Days, which is absolutely exquisite. And I can't wait to share that conversation with you. So until then, remember, we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings you next, and love each and every moment of your very precious life. Bye-bye.